Thank you so much, Boris, for that very energetic, inspiring introduction, which really cuts to the heart of many of the questions and themes that preoccupy us. And I just want to say before I go on that it's always a marvelous experience to be back at the Haus der Kultur in der Welt, and I don't think I've ever had such a close view of the pregnant oyster in my life. But thank you very much, Bernd Scherer, Olga von Schubert, and all the colleagues at the House for creating these marvelous occasions where we can come together and discuss the perplexities and adventures that we're engaged on. I've actually, for the last 2 weeks, been rereading one of my favorite books, which is a strange and uncharacterizable literary production called Third Factory, with which some of you are doubtless familiar. It was a book that the Soviet philologist, Viktor Shklovsky wrote at a later point in his life. And somewhere in the midst of this enigmatic production, he says, flowers are unreliable as opposed to botany. And I find this talismanic, this sentence, when we talk about questions of language and of translation. Because language, linguistic practice, translatorial strategies are like these flowers which are unreliable. Whilst botany, the theories that we try and map onto these practices, that kind of theoretical botany is reliable, but possibly it guides us away from what we need to look at. So with that cautionary note, I'm going to go into what I have to say. We have half an hour each, right, Boris? I want to begin by, I realize I've said that several times, I want to begin, but I'm actually beginning this paper now. For biographical reasons, because I grew up in a highly multilingual family and belong to a diasporic ethnic group that has moved from one place to another various times in the last several centuries, there has never been a time when I wasn't aware of translation in a very deep, experiential, and existential sense. It was never for me an academic practice. It was never for me something that I came to later. I knew it as a child. I lived interlingually. I still live interlingually. And it's that kind of awareness, as well as the artisanal approach of a poet and a translator, that I want to try and bring to this. And I therefore take it very personally when translation and the conditions of diversity and of interlinguality that on which translation thrives, when those conditions are threatened, as they are threatened in my country at this point, in India, when they're threatened by a politics that is unitary, that is centralizing, that flattens diversity, and that is in love with a notion of the standard. Something you alluded to, Boris, the notion that there might be universal strategies of dealing with language, with experience, with expertise, and that anything that is, as I said, quoting Shklovsky, unreliable, is suspect. And in a context like this, when you have a politics that's based on abstractions concerning religious identity, linguistic orthodoxy, a sense of the nation state as being paramount, or notions of community identity that are hard-edged. What gets destroyed is the plurality of forms of being. What gets destroyed is the plurality of forms of communication. What gets destroyed also is the everydayness of code switching, as we would speak of it in a social linguistic context. In place of that, what you have are very, very hard-edged notions of correct speech, or correct rendering. And in any reasonably complex society, it is these everyday accidents and moments of code switching, of moving from one register to another, of cutting against the grain of language, that is what makes linguistic and all other forms of affective experience meaningful. And that's the political context in relation to which I want to develop these remarks. So over on the one hand, you have an understanding of language and therefore of translation that comes from what is finally a romantic legacy. The notion that a particular nation, a particular community can only be linked to one kind of language, and that that language has a very clear definition. And I'll say more about what I regard as the very spurious notion of the dialect as I go along. Linked to this understanding of language is the dangerous doctrine, and I'm very painfully aware as I say this that I'm in Berlin, the dangerous doctrine of a mystical national collectivity. Over against that, what I want to reach out to in these remarks is notions of transregionality, notions of how osmotic language and linguistic practice can be, and how through that kind of osmotic linguistic practice, which calls upon and summons us to translation, we fashion ourselves in the space of an improvised sociality. Yeah, so to bounded, territorial, romantic notions of national language, I would oppose this kind of osmotic transregionality and an improvised sociality. And in this context, I would suggest that, and I will build on what Boris said, translation cannot be seen, as it too often is, both in literary and in everyday circles. It cannot be seen as simply a practice geared to teleporting texts from one language to another, with all of the deficits and gains that are attended upon this transfer. And there is, of course, a vast academic literature, as well as debates, theoretical disquisitions, translators' memoirs, and so forth, that deal with this question. They all rest on the dogma of the original, on the dogma, on the almost theological certainty that there is an original text, that it, knowing it, is a talisman of authenticity, and that all translations are somehow deficient. I want to try and take another kind of view of translation here. I want to be able to think about the expanded definitions and applicabilities of translation as an unpredictable medium, as something that has not only instrumental, but also transfigurative qualities. Translation as a medium that can be expansive, that can improvise. Translation not as a subset of linguistic practice, but sometimes as a superset of cultural life. Something that makes culture possible, something that transforms culture in radical and unprecedented ways. I would like to argue, modestly enough, for translation as a poetics of self-dismantling, and for translation as a politics of self-refashioning. I want to look at occasions historically where translation has actually served these purposes, where it's done these things that I claim that it's done. And as an aside, I'm just going to remind us of how central to the originary moment of print modernity translation was. I hate to offend my German hosts by pointing out that the Gutenberg Bible was not actually the first printed book in history. That honor goes to a text called the Vajracchedika Prajnaparamita Sutra, the Diamond Sutra, which was printed in Dunhuang in China in 868 AD. So whether you're looking at the Vajracchedika, which is a Chinese translation of a Sanskrit original, or the Gutenberg Bible, a Latin rendering of a Hebrew and Greek original, we're looking at translation at that moment of print modernity that then went on to define everything that we take for granted by way of our contemporary lives. And along with that come all of these questions. How do we reclaim a past? How do we assert the agency of a vernacular? How do we deal with the classical? What does that even mean in terms of a living legacy? How do we revolutionize access to language and at the same time open up questions of authenticity, originality, and the version? So these are by way of my opening thoughts. And as a roadmap, I want to dwell on three signs. I want to think of translation in relation to what I've called anamnesia. I will then go on to try and spell out a few remarks on how translation can build into a form of resistance. And I will then dwell a little on a very vexed term that both defines our lives and yet summons up our critical responses, the notion of a cosmopolitanism. I'll begin with anamnesia. Anamnesia, as many of you know, of course, is at one level a refusal to forget. It's a form of recollection. But also, and interestingly, the etymology takes us to an inventory of symptoms and tendencies. Anamnesia is also the word we use to describe a patient's medical history. And I would reach for a Sanskrit word here to talk about amnesia. The word is abhidnana, which is a very particular kind of recognition. It's the recall of what was always known, but which has become eclipsed over a period of time. And under this sign, what I want to do is to recall a brief genealogy of pivotal moments, traces, experiences, institutions, where translation has played the kind of formative political role of the kind that I indicated in my introduction. So I'm going to look briefly and as far as the light allows at seven of these crucibles or contact zones. Has something come on? Okay. If you're looking at what I'm looking at, that should be the title page of the Vajracheteka, the first printed book in history from Dun Huang. And I have this there is as a way of invoking the kinds of transcultural transactions, encounters, and collaborations that took place in what Aurel Stein, the Hungarian-British explorer and scholar, called Serindia, a border zone. And I hesitate to use the word border zones because borders are centers of their own. The area that drew on Central Asia, India, Persia, and China. It was an interface zone between Mahayana Buddhism and Imperial China. And it was there that a translator, a Kashmiri translator called Kumarajiva, translated some of the longer Mahayana sutras into Chinese. And they're called the Vaipulya Sutras, the long sutras, of which the Vajracheteka, the Diamond Sutra, is one. When you look closely at these, at this particular moment, you find that a number of these long sutras don't seem to have originals in Sanskrit. And this is conventionally put down to the notion that these were destroyed over long periods under conditions of invasion and so on and so forth. But I think it's possible, or at least it's not impossible, that the long sutras were not actually translations of existing, pre-existing originals. They were very probably developed in relation to the translator's sense of the recipient culture, the notions of what a doctrine might need to acquire in terms of an aesthetic context in which to extend itself. So the kinds of rich, even Baroque descriptions that you have in the Vaipulya Sutras have less to do with the austerity of Buddhist doctrine and more to do with what might have made sense to an imperial culture. So I have this as an example of what translation can do and mean as not simply a transfer of one set of resources to another context, but as how, in fact, it can mean a reimagining, a revisiting, and a comprehensive remaking of the so-called original. So that's one of the moments of translation that I want to place before you. Because I also want us to think about how translation is not only this kind of in-between space of transference, but it is actually a zone of active cultural imagining. I'm going to move on to, if you're seeing what I'm seeing, that's Baghdad in the 8th and 9th centuries, an institution called the Bayt al-Hikmah, the House of Wisdom, which was what we would today call a kind of Hakave space, actually. A space of research, of collection, of translation, of dialogue among scholars coming from different kinds of disciplines and backgrounds. It was sustained by the Abbasid Caliphate, specifically by Mansur and by Harun al-Rashid, who were its patrons. And for me, this moment in the history of translation is crucial because it tells us about the afterlives and rebirths of texts, which moved from the Sanskrit and the Greek into Arabic translation. And then began a long journey that went across North Africa to Al-Andalus, the Mediterranean, and made their way here to Europe. That is how the Jatakas and the Panchatantra from the Sanskrit, story cycles, as well as medical, I spoke of anamnesia as a patient's medical history. It was also through the Bayt al-Hikmah, for instance, that Sanskrit medical treatises by Charaka and Sushruta, for instance, made their way through the Arabic into North Africa and into Europe. Likewise, Plato, Galen, Aristotle, Pythagoras, what is conventionally seen as a natural and normalized European inheritance, but which actually didn't even exist in Europe for centuries. It came, if you will, back, or rather came to modern Europe through this institution. It also sustained an efflorescence of Islamic science, philosophy, and inquiry. Names like Al-Razi, Al-Kindi, Al-Khwarizmi, which are probably lost today, were beneficiaries and participants in an institution like this, as later were Ibn Sina and Ibn Rushd, Avicenna and Averroes. So for me, this moment in the history of translation speaks of how institutions of sharing and collaboration and inquiry can be built in ways that far exceed this mandate of translation as a somehow simple business of hydraulics. That something else is going on here. There is, without, take translation away from this institution and this narrative, and a considerable part of our cultural subjectivity simply disappears. It is this kind of crucial and seminal nature of translation to which I want to point. I'm going to take that narrative further to Toledo in the 12th and 13th centuries. This is the school of translators, which was sustained again in conditions of antagonism and conflict, which is usually the narrative you hear from this period in the history of Iberia. Alongside that antagonism and conflict, as many of you undoubtedly know, were also immense histories of collaboration, of convivencia, of living and working together apart from and past difference. So at an institution like the School of Translators, the Baghdad story went one step further, that Arab learning came into Latin through team translations. And those teams of translators brought together radically dissimilar people, Arabic-speaking Jews on the one hand, and Christian scholars who were, of course, Latin specialists. And I begin to wonder what it might have been like for these people with their very different customs, dietary preferences, religious convictions. What was it like to come together in a space and pick up on texts that came from yet more distant places? In what ways did translation in Toledo in this moment, for instance, produce things that were not predictable from the starting points? It's that unpredictable excess that translation produces that I would like to emphasize in this context. From this kind of culture also emerged figures like Musa ibn Maimun al-Qurtubi, who for obscure reasons is called Maimonides, a name he never bore in his life. And it reminds us that it was in this context of translation, for instance, that you could have a foundational text of modern Judaism that was written in Arabic. Given our present politics, it seems almost impossible to imagine a time when this is exactly what happened. This is a historical fact. Once again, what role does translation play in sustaining these kinds of these simultaneous antagonism, conflict, difference, as well as these moments of high convergence and collaboration? That closer to home is the world of Agra, Lahore, and Delhi. The painting is actually in Dublin. And it comes from an album that celebrates the Emperor Akbar, who was a syncretic, versatile figure who invited to his court protagonists, exponents of diverse religions, and inaugurated the great translation projects that Mughal India is really should be famous for. I'm not sure it's famous for it in the larger world, but it's really the Mughal emperors who set going the translations of the, not only of the classics, of the Ramayana and the Mahabharata, which are the great Indian epics, but also of story cycles like the Panchatantra, as well as works written in languages that have fallen below the radar as far as most people are concerned. And I'll come back to that point. Languages like Avadhi and Braj Bhasha, and I'm aware that I'm simply bombarding you with strange chimerical names, but I'm asking for your patience. I will annotate these languages shortly. The reason I put this forward is because Mughal India is one of those periods in our history which is currently under the scanner as far as our dispensation in India is concerned. They are eager to present it as a time of Islamic orthodoxy and rooting out of diversity and so on and so forth. It's exactly like some of my compatriots who criticize Sheldon Pollock, who actually knows his Sanskrit, which they don't. It's exactly like that. An awareness of detail would transform our sense of what the lived reality of this period was, how very multilingual it was, and how translation was a survival tactic. Translation was also a way of enriching and expanding and refashioning the self. So I find myself inspired by these examples precisely because in our professional lives, if you will, we're all too often confining ourselves to a particular text, a particular author, a particular set of occasions in what is finally the publishing industry of the literary world. I think it actually blows some of those preconceptions away if we look at how risky an activity translation was at various points and what kind of wager on subjectivity and selfhood it involved. I'm going to now move on again in the course of these remarks to three examples where I'll dwell specifically on how translation transformed doctrine. So far I've been talking about translation where the self is expanded. But what happens when translation actually transforms religious doctrine, which you would assume, commonsensically as it were, you would assume that that was impossible to touch. The translation simply had to fall down and worship and do its best. But I'm offering you three examples where you actually have a certain latitude towards these things. If you're seeing what I'm seeing, which you probably aren't, are you seeing a very misty stone on which there are Greek characters? Okay, fabulous. That is the Kandahar edict. That is one of Ashoka's bilingual edicts. Ashoka was an emperor who ruled India in 258 BCE. Olga, I have to apologize. You emphasized the number of posts, and I seem to be heading the other direction towards the pre-colonial and the pre-modern. But the reason I have this here is because Ashoka, some of you might know this, but for the record, he was a highly unusual ruler. He presided over a genocide in eastern India, which transformed him. And he gave up war, more or less, converted to Buddhism, and then threw all that passionate energy into spreading Buddhism. And one of the means of doing that was to have these rock edicts for his people across what is South Asia. So this is actually in Pakistan. It was discovered in 1958. It's an edict. Essentially, it's the message of the Buddhist Dhamma, or the moral order, in Greek and in Aramaic. They're both translations of an original text which was written in a language called Magadhi, but I won't bore you with details. My point here is that the word Dhamma in a Buddhist context has a very particular meaning. It is the notion of a moral order that does not rest on the presence of any divine principle. Buddhism does not have a god. The Greek word by which Dhamma is rendered in that edict is eusebeia. And eusebeia, as some of you probably know, comes from a very different religious context where it refers to a piety that's based on honoring the gods and therefore receiving the blessing of the gods. So what does that tell us about an emperor who was utterly committed to his Buddhist beliefs, but who could yet, in the context of reaching out and making common cause and arriving at a certain ethical understanding together with his subjects, who was willing to use a translation that he or his collegium knew to be inaccurate? So I want to dwell here on a particular kind of inaccuracy in translation as related to a doctrine. It's not Dhamma at all. The assumptions on which Eusebeia rests are completely the opposite of the assumptions on which the concept of Dhamma rests. And yet you have here a moment, if you will, of a compact between a ruler and his Greek-speaking subjects, where another kind of affective extension is made, and that seems to be more important than the notion of a strict literal accuracy. More ancient Indo-Greek pictures. Do you have two coins up there? A reverse and an obverse. Okay, that's an example of what's called Bactrian Greek coinage. It comes from 100 BC. And for me, this moment in northwestern India is extremely intriguing and interesting because it's a moment where different languages, different religious conceptions come together. And just as Dhamma and Eusebeia come into a certain kind of asymmetric relationship, you have very new conceptions of kingship coming into play through the legends on these coins. Because you have a notion of divine kingship that emerges essentially from a Persian and Greek context coming into India. And you have arising from the cults that are reflected in these coins, the notion of a Tratara, a savior. It's rendered as Megasota on some of these coins, the great savior. You have a notion of soteriology that does not pre-exist in Indic religion, and it comes in here, and it gets mapped through, it's just a coin in a collection somewhere, but it reminds us of these tumultuous changes where what we have is a residue of translation, tells us about these incredible changes and transformations in religious life, in intellectual frameworks, and how it was through language, the coming together of incompatible ideas in language, that you have something else, a third thing, which is really not, it does not pre-exist. So how does translation allow people to make that kind of radical leap is something I would dwell on as well. And I have lost the cursor. Another coin, which comes again from a period that is today highly contested in the Indian public sphere. This is a coin from 1128, from the mid 1100s. And it's a coin that was minted by Mahmud Ghazni, who is demonized today in the Indian context as an Islamic invader. I'm asking you to take all this terminology in heavy quotes, because the closer you look at the detail of all of this, the more you realize that you're looking at people who were complex, who were cosmopolitan in their own strange way, and who were willing to exercise different kinds of latitude. So the person who's remembered as a tyrant today actually minted this coin, which has on one side of it a Sanskrit rendition of the Kalima, which is the Islamic profession of faith. So in India, this man is viewed as an oppressor of Hindus. What the coins tell you is quite another story, that it actually is the Islamic profession of faith with one important shift. The Sanskrit goes, Avyaktam Ekam Muhammad Avatara Nrupati Mahmud. The first two terms in that are, there is no God but God, and Muhammad is his. In the Arabic, as some of you know, the word is Rasul, messenger. In the Sanskrit version, it's Avatar, which is not Rasul. Yeah. Okay? So instead of Muhammad Rasulillah, it says Muhammad Avatar. That is heresy in Islam, as many of you undoubtedly know. So what was a ruler who identified himself as a protector of Islam, who is remembered as an oppressor of Hindus, doing with this heretical legend on his coins? And again, this invites us to, this compelling shift invites us to think about what kind of catalytic role translation plays at moments like this. It's a mistranslation, but with a reason. The Sanskrit word duta, which is messenger, which would be Rasul in Arabic, cuts no particular ice in terms of prestige in a Sanskrit context. It simply means minion. So the idea of the prophet as minion would be meaningless to Mahmud of Ghazni's new subjects. So he had to reach for a theological concept that had that kind of prestige, even if it had nothing whatever to do with Islamic theology. The avatar, as many of you know, is the worldly manifestation of a great divinity. So you have, for me, this is an incredible collusion, not a collision, of cultures that takes place here. And again, it's a small example. It's just a coin sitting in a museum somewhere. But I like to think of it as a moment where translation plays this kind of catalytic role in establishing affective connections that actually have very little to do with whatever propaganda translation is supposed to convey. And in the 5 minutes that I have, I'm going to move on very briskly. There seems to be heaps more to say, but I'm going to save it. I'm going to focus really on one example here to talk about translation as resistance. So far, I've offered you examples of translation in under the sign of anamnesia. I'm going to simply discuss very, very briefly, packing in several hundred years of history, I'm going to discuss this notion of the official language or the mother tongue in an Indian context. And I'm going to try and unpack it to demonstrate how this dogma has actually generated a linguistic impoverishment. And that linguistic impoverishment goes together with and is related to other forms of diminution of cultural subjectivity and citizenship in India. And that's the focus of my inquiry briefly. Sheldon Pollack, whose work is doubtless familiar to many of you, in his marvelous book, The Language of the Gods in the World of Men, which is a study of what he calls the Sanskrit cosmopolis, which is the transcontinental reach of a language that originated in India, which is thought to be a scriptural language, but actually is very, very rich in secular and other applications. In the course of this, Pollack points out that South Asia traditionally has had an emphasis on multiple first language capabilities. Most South Asians before modernity, whenever you want to assign modernity, and today, actually have multiple first language capabilities. The notion of a mother tongue, even that word, did not exist in any Indian language until the encounter with the colonial encounter and the access to Romanticism and its particular doctrines. What modern India, what post-colonial India has done in a certain way is to commit itself to a divisive and depleting politics of language by enshrining the idea that various regions are wedded to various languages, so the country is divided into linguistic states, and in each of those linguistic states, the language is enshrined in a so-called official standard. And all variations on it are somehow seen to be stigmatized, often as dialects. And my blood boils when I hear that word dialect, because it is largely meaningless. And I'm going to focus this on Hindi, which is one of the official languages of India. Because it's a cautionary tale about how this kind of thinking about language can not only produce violence between languages, but it can also produce violence within a language. So the Hindi, that is the official language of India today, is a highly Sanskritized 20th century production. It arises from the work of theoreticians through the latter half of the 19th century who wanted, on the one hand, to, from a Hindu majoritarian point of view, to purify the language of Arabic and Persian influences. So they characterized Urdu or Hindustani as something to be set at a distance. They also declared war on what they felt to be, for all kinds of reasons, feudal, ornate, or unduly erotic uses of language. So languages like Awadhi and Braj Bhasha were derogated, and so many different names. A language called Khadi Boli was used as the basis because it seemed to be robust and masculine. There's also a strange debate about masculinity, which undergirds these choices. What that has done is actually to take away from our consciousness the notion that the languages that fed into Hindi were not a hierarchy, ranging from the standard to the dialects. They actually were a continuum. And they were a continuum that produced great literature. And people say this without contradiction. They describe Awadhi as a dialect, and they forget that Awadhi produced great works of literature, like the Ramcharitmanas. They characterize Braj Bhasha as a dialect. They forget that there's a vast body of literature across the country, written in that language. So how do you derogate and dismiss entire languages and literatures because you're so committed to your notion of language as arranged in some kind of normalized, naturalized hierarchy? So I would argue that as translators, we should constantly be aware of how most languages, most language families are our continua. And as we range across the spectrum of these linguistic choices, it enriches us, it does not constrain us. And I'm going to end really with having lamented this loss of texture and granularity and the death of languages in India. I'm going to pin this to a very particular example. Over the last 2 years, this is a matter of policy. Over the last 2 years, India has been discussing, that is to say, the Indian government has been discussing a draft Forest Act. And when forestry is talked about in India, what the government has in mind is really plantation-style forests. It does not refer to any kind of natural proliferation. It refers to the planting of forests in a very aggressive kind of way. So on the one hand, you have this plantation-style notion of forests, which does not recognize wetlands, swamps, grasslands, deserts, as being part of this natural order at all. All of those are natural forms that have to be destroyed or tamed, as the word goes. Over against that, I would place the social, the linguistic fact that we are losing languages that had rich, precise, and granular vocabularies for each one of these natural forms. There were many, many words in Rajasthani, for instance, for kinds of rain, for kinds of desert. All of this is vanishing. And the death of those vocabularies is intimately linked to the kind of unitary, monolithic forms of governance and exploitation and extractive governance that we are committing ourselves to. So I want to end by reminding us that these questions of language and translation that we're thinking about are not merely personal choices. They are not confined only to texts. They also have to do with very, very large scale questions of how we participate in a larger polity. Thank you very much for your attention.